Creation evolution question is not a trivial issue. Okay, what they are, I put it this way, it's also not just a few scientists are arguing this or a few creationists are arguing it. These are the two models for how the world works. Every aspect of it. You're either on one side or the other. It should be of interest to everyone. It is the two opposing worldviews. Okay? What is more alarming is the desperate lengths that reputable men will be willing to go to when their foundation of perspective is being threatened. And in one way, this is kind of understandable. If you've ever been talking with somebody about your beliefs, and suddenly they start asking questions or presenting evidence that you haven't run into, and you feel like you're a little shaky in your position, one of the things you do is start yelling, you know, or getting a little mad. It's the way you cover yourself, you know, or you just get a little frustrated. Or so when scientists, from their position, begin to find that, you know, they're being questioned in certain ways that they can't answer. And when you point out to them that the very laws of science that they're the guardians of are contradicting their belief, they're going to do a lot of things. They're going to start getting a little bit intimidative. And they're also going to start, and this is, yeah, this, they're going to start jinking with things. Now, it's one of the things we have to realize that a scientist, you know, is not flawless. They are subject to what any human is subject to. In fact, I remember I had an issue of Science News, which is usually the small little newspaper that they hand out in high school. And one of them goes into all the problems that these guys that are trying to get their doctorates and stuff are foible to. And one of them is plagiarism. So that's part of it. I mean, they have, you know, other people do their work for them, or they steal it, you know, from some maybe European, you know, paper or whatever, hoping that the professor hasn't read it yet. Okay, that's one of the reasons. So they're not above lying. And even out in the world, when push comes to shove and the pressure's on, they got families to feed. Sometimes, you know, they're going to mess with things in order to present them in the way that they think the donors want it to appear. And that's in any circumstance. I mean, it takes a person of high moral fiber in order to stand their ground into what they believe, even if they're in danger of being fired. The trouble with the scientist, if he's not also a believer in God, where is he going to get the moral fiber from? Yeah, you don't get it from science. Okay. In fact, one of the things I remember was an experiment with Z-rays. Now, I kid you not, because they figured there was X-rays, there was probably something like Z-rays. And so there was this guy in Europe, he supposedly put together this apparatus that, you know, would actually demonstrate the existence of Z-rays. And he had all these people from the French Academy of Science coming, and they're looking at it. And it was a case of the king's new clothes. None of these guys wanted to admit it, that once, you know, once this thing was turned on, that they couldn't see anything. They figured everybody else was seeing something, so they kept going, oh, yeah, I see it. And so they got rid up in the journals and everything else, until finally somebody started building the apparatus, going, we don't see nothing. And even then, it took a while, you know, to finally, you know, prove that, you know, this guy was blowing smoke. Okay, so it happens. Okay, so on the one hand, we want to kind of understand what's going on just because, you know, these guys are human. So you don't put them on a pedestal, just as you don't put a preacher on a pedestal either, you know, because we're all foible. We're just not trying to understand the foibles here. Okay, and that when scientists are putting, you know, put the pressure on, they're going to start playing with things. Right? So in an article, by a British physicist, H.S. Lipson, that appeared in May 1980 issue of Physics Bulletin, he wrote, in fact, evolution became, in a sense, a scientific religion. Almost all scientists have accepted it, and many are prepared to bend their observations to fit with it. And then he has, you know, adds, to my mind, the theory doesn't stand up at all. So here you have a physicist writing that, you know, he's saying, I've looked at it, hopefully with an open mind, and said, you know, the evolution model doesn't fit. But he says, my colleagues are starting to bend their information in order to conform to it. And he calls it, you know, properly, it is for them a scientific religion. Even the Supreme Court realized in some of the arguments that evolution is a religion. It's a worldview. It's a philosophy. So if you can't teach religion in school, you really can't teach evolution either. And the reason, you know, this is something else we'll probably bring out now. We may bring it out again in one of the other things. But, you know, for the scientists, it's not that this load of information was put out there and they said, oh, okay, obviously there's no such thing as God. This is the way the world happened. No, what you get was a lot of people like Huxley from the beginning. I mean, even Darwin was kind of, you know, wishy-washy about it. You know, he wasn't sure. I mean, if you read his stuff, it's very like it seems. He's kind of, you know, putting forth things just for somebody else to look at. It was Huxley that took it and ran with it, and a lot of other scientists, because they didn't want to believe in the supernatural. And evolution was the only alternative. That's why they bought into it, hook, line, and sinker. They had to go with it. If you don't believe in God, you've got to go with evolution. No science about it. So what we have here is some of these guys beginning to wake up to the fact of, okay, we go through all these science courses and we learn all these rules and we learn all these laws that we've come up with, and then we start pushing evolution as, you know, presented by the scientists, but now they're starting to look at how come what we're pushing here violates all the rules. Okay, some are willing to admit it. Okay. What is happening is that many scientists are beginning to realize that the formal hallowed laws of science are turning out to be more supportive of the creation model than the evolutionary model. The result is that the laws of science themselves are now under attack. I mean, isn't that what we showed last week with Darwin? You know, if reason leads him to God, let's attack reason. With all the science, you know, rules of science are saying, hey, it's more plausible for the creation model than evolution. Let's get rid of the laws of science. And so that in this lesson, we'll demonstrate the nature of this attack and the law of causality and why it supports creation and why they're trying to get rid of it. Okay. First of all, in this law of causality is what we're calling the laws of cause and effect. Indisputably, it's the most universal of scientific laws. Okay, in science, laws are seen as reflecting actual regularities in nature. That is, why we call something a law is because you can see it happening over and over and over again without change. I mean, if somebody writes up, I did this experiment and I got this, it should be able that any scientist anywhere in the world under the same conditions can put that same experiment together and get exactly the same thing. Then you know it's a science. If it happened only once, this is why I said last week, when we're talking about evolution or creation, those are one-time events. They really are not in the realm of science. Okay, you can't put it in a test tube. You know, you can't write a journal about it, and some guy across the planet, you know, duplicate the same thing, you know, and get the same result. Okay, it's more of a historical event because evolution hasn't happened since. So we're looking at regularities. Now, this law of cause and effect has been stated many ways. Okay, everything that happens begins to be or presupposes something which follows according to the rule. That's Kant, Critique of Pure Reason. Nothing happens, these are just various quotations, nothing happens without a reason why it should happen rather than not happen. Okay, the same guy, Richard von Mises, also observed, we may only add that almost all philosophers regard the law of causality as the most important law of science. There is hardly a more useful and more reliable rule of behavior than to assume of any occurrence that we come to know that some other one has, you know, some other occurrence has preceded it. Okay? Simply stated, okay, if you see something happening, something caused it. Okay? Put it another way. Guys, if your wife quits talking to you, don't you automatically assume you did something wrong? Cause and effect. Okay? This is not something that, yeah, I mean, this is the way we look at things. You know, if you're walking down the street and all of a sudden the street gets clogged with all sorts of vehicles, you know, screaming down there and all sorts of crowds are yelling and screaming running by you, you don't think it's par for the course. You know, your mind starts wondering, you know, what's around the corner? Godzilla or King Kong or whatever? You know, something's got to start all this panic. Cause and effect. I mean, that's the world we live by. Anytime we see something, we know something caused it. Biggest law we got. Scientific law. Otherwise, we assume if we put something down, it's going to stay there until something moves it. That's it. If there's nothing to cause it to move, it's not going to move. We all believe it. Now, you may think somebody moved your car keys or your purse or whatever, but you know, if it did, you know somebody had to do it. You know, if you can't find something like your wallet, you go, somebody picked my pocket. Instead of thinking, oh, I mislaid it, we always assume something happened. Okay? Law. Okay. Simply put, the law of causality states that every material effect must have an adequate antecedent cause. Obviously, then, if every material effect has an adequate antecedent cause, antecedent, maybe I'll explain that, just means something that goes before it. In English, when we talk about a pronoun must agree with its antecedent, we're just talking about what's the thing that came first. You know, with a pronoun, the she, the he, the it, we know you don't start off a sentence with he, she, or it because nobody knows what you're talking about. We usually start off a sentence with, you know, Johnny threw the ball, okay? And he broke a vase. Okay. Using the he then, referring back to the antecedent Johnny, we always know what the he refers to. So you have to have that first thing, you know, that antecedent, before you can have anything else. So what the cause is an antecedent to the effect. So anytime you have an effect, before that there's got to be a cause. Something has to put it into motion. Obviously, then, if every material effect has an adequate antecedent cause, and if the universe is a material effect, this world is a dynamic flux and matrix of motion. It's everything's moving. Even as you're sitting there, you're moving. You got all these little atoms in you with all these little electrons screaming around this little nucleus. You're moving, even as you're sitting there. The wind blows, the sun shines. Our sentences are full of verbs because all this motion is going on. Something had to start it. Like I said last week, well, have you seen that thing move yet? Because nobody's done that. See, if you got a molecule sitting out in deep space, just sitting there, it ain't it's not going to suddenly evolve into a Ford Fairlane. Okay? It just doesn't work that way. Something's got to cause it to be added to something else and whatever. So there's always something prior to it. And the same with our universe. The universe is a material effect. It's a thing in motion. Somebody had to set it to do that. Somebody had to cause it. We also know, as stated in last week, that the effect is never quantitatively greater or qualitatively superior to the cause. If you see, or you can imagine, all the power in the universe, all the gravitational pulls of suns and moons and everything on the respective planets around them, or on each other, plus the amount of power that's put out when a gigantic sun explodes. It wipes out whole solar systems, and maybe even solar systems next to it. All that incredible power cannot be greater than the power that created it. What is released in an explosion cannot be greater than the force, God, that pushed it together. All the suns in all the solar systems and of all the galaxies in the whole universe, all the power that's displayed there is not greater than the power that made it all, God. And to add to that, all the intellects, all the smart people through the ages, all the mentalities of the Stephen Hawkings or the Einsteins or the Galileos or the Da Vincis or whatever, all of them put together cannot be greater than the wisdom and the mind that created them all. Man is not smarter than his maker. That's a law. The attacks upon this law, perhaps the most famous skeptic of the law of cause and effect, was the British imperialist David Hume. Okay? However, as fervently as Hume was in his criticism, he never went so far as to assert that the law of cause and effect did not exist. It's there. Okay? His problem was he simply felt that it was not empirically verifiable and stemmed instead from a... Okay, this word can be pronounced two ways. It's up to you. Okay. The I's are pronounced as E's, A, pre, re, or they're pronounced as I's, long I's, A, prior, rye. One or the other. Don't mix them up. Okay. But what it means is that he says that it's all theory. Because you're talking about, as you go back, there's always a cause to the effect, and you're working your way back, what about that first cause? It's got to have a beginning. And he's going, that's theoretical. That's his only argument. He really didn't get rid of the whole thing, but his whole thing was, just, you know, this is all theory. Okay? But that was the crux of it. That's the worst of it. Another way that causality has been attacked is the argument that insists that the principle must be false because it's inconsistent with itself. If the principle of cause and effect says that everything must have a cause, it traces everything back to the first cause where it stops suddenly. Okay? So why is it that this first cause does not likewise need a cause? They say, you're being inconsistent. Yeah, we'll explain that. Okay? The reason this is here, have you ever heard of the expression throwing a monkey wrench into the works? Okay, that's what we're doing with all the arguments against, first this law and then creation. There are two responses that may be offered to the complaint about causality. Okay, now we're arguing against the argument against causality. Okay, first, it is impossible logically to defend any concept of infinite regress that postulates an endless series of effects with no ultimate first cause. I mean, can you go back and back and back and back and back and back, you know, ad infinitum? No. No. Because you still got to figure out what started all this. Got to come from someplace. Philosophers have argued that point correctly for generations. Whatever begins to exist must have a cause. If it exists, if it's in motion, it's whatever, something caused it. Nothing causeless happens. The second is the complaint offered by skeptics suggesting that the law of causality is inconsistent with itself is not a valid objection, because the law, rather it is an objection to the incorrect statement of the law. If you go back to section 8.3 and you look at how we bolded it in, notice it doesn't say that every cause has an effect, every effect has a cause, but every material effect has a cause. Every material effect. Now, let me explain that. We've been talking about inanimate things, you know, getting them started. But now, what motivated me to push that? Okay. Now, two things we have to understand. You know, as our bodies are in motion, okay, we talked about this last week, is that scientists, as they look at, you know, what causes the mind to work, the one guy that showed, you know, there's something that's going on. It's not just a mechanical, you know, firing of the synapses. Okay, it's not just something that's, you know, boiling up inside of us that causes things to happen. There's something there that can't be detected, which he's calling the will. Okay. There's a will behind the motion. You know, this hand is doing what I want it to. Okay. So it's a will causing the physical effect. Now, on the one hand, you can't put forth that my will can be pushed to do something. Like, I wanted to do this because I'm trying to make a point. So your need to know, or my feeling that you need to know something, is kind of causing my will to do things in order to get my point across. But we also talk of the will as, you know, when you look at why did you do something? And there may not be any outside stimulus. And we use words like because I wanted to, or I was bored. Okay, I wanted, or I desired to do something. Okay, nothing forced it. Nothing caused the will to do what it was doing, to be imaginative, to think about something. We don't know where that comes from, unless it's God. But in that case, our will, with no cause whatsoever, caused our body to do something. So even though the physical needs a, you know, first cause, the mind doesn't. It just may come up with a reason to do something. And the same with our universe. All we're talking about, there had to be a first cause to the universe in getting it started. But what caused God to do that? He didn't need a reason. He didn't need a prior pushing. He did it because he wanted to. It doesn't have to go back beyond that. A will that was powerful, or had control of powerful things, got it all started as a first cause. You know, it was something in the mind of God that he wanted to do, and nothing had to prompt it. Nothing had to set that in motion except him himself. A lot of this, let's see. Oh, we need this one. John Gerstner in Reasons of Faith, or Reasons for Faith, correctly reasoned, because every effect must have a cause, there must ultimately be one cause that is not an effect, but pure cause, Or how indeed can one explain effects? A cause that is itself an effect would not explain anything, but require another explanation. But the argument has shown that the universe as we know it is an effect and cannot be self-explanatory. It requires something to explain it which is not like itself an effect. It must have an uncaused cause. And that point stands, even among philosophers who are really not arguing for God. Just in their arguments, they found out we need something like God in order to explain what we're looking at. This is why things are beginning to change in the scientific community. On November 5th, 1981, Colin Patterson, and I love this guy and what he did. He's a senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History in London, and one of the world's foremost evolutionary experts. He delivered an address to his evolutionist colleagues at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and he astonished his colleagues by saying, "One morning, I woke up and something had happened in the night." Now, I wonder what caused that. And it struck me that I had been working on this stuff, evolution, for 20 years. And there was not one thing I knew about it. That's quite a shock to learn that one can be misled for so long. In fact, he didn't leave it there. He went and asked the simple question, "Can you tell me anything you know about evolution, any one thing that is true?" And he did this to the geology staff at the Field Museum of Natural History, and the only answer he got was silence. I mean, think about it. You got a dinosaur bone. What do you know about that? Do you know how old it is? Well, it's like a million years old. How do you know that? Well, we found it in a million-year-old strata of the Earth. How do you know that strata is a million years old? Because we found a million-year-old bone in it. Circular reasoning, that's where they come from. Do you know anything in science that can prove that bone is a million years old? Well, we think we have some carbon dating tests. I got news for you. Carbon's not accurate after 5,000 years. It burns itself out completely after 10,000. And guess what? This ain't carbon. It's calcium. How do you know this thing's a million years old? Well, I guess I don't. Do you know anything about evolution that's true? You got a room full of scientists that base their life on this stuff and haven't got a clue. Haven't got an answer to this guy. He had the courage to ask the question that nobody else was answering themselves. He didn't leave it there. He tried the same question at the evolutionary morphology seminar at the University of Chicago, a very prestigious body of evolutionists. He got the same silence until one person finally said, "It does seem that the level of knowledge about evolution is remarkably shallow. We know it not taught be taught in high school." But that's where they start with it. Young, impressionable minds, you know, in the lower grades, even in the elementary school. They start teaching this stuff. It's pushed by the National Geographic and others. I mean, look at the Science Channel more and more. It's evolution. But what proof have you got for it, guys? No proof. Just an agenda. Just an agenda. Pierre-Paul Grasset, the man whose knowledge of the living world has been called encyclopedic, authored The Evolution of Living Organisms, in which he stated, "Today our duty is to destroy the myth of evolution." I mean, this guy knows more about it than anybody else. He wrote the book on it. And considered as a simple understood and explained phenomena which keeps rapidly unfolding before us. So, you know, no such thing happens. I mean, just like we pointed out, Nick, last week I used my drinking cup and I put the bell there. You know, two examples. And the time it's been sitting there, or I could say it could sit there from now till doomsday. Do we expect that bell to be anything else but than a bell? As long as man has been here, has man evolved into being anything else but the dumb ox that he's always been? Think about it. I mean, have we been put in a pressure cooker? You know, I grew up high school. You know, that was the atomic age, nuclear age, whatever. You know, people were building in the 50s air raid shelters, you know, waiting for the bomb to drop. You know, every generation now has got, it's been almost 7 years now, or over 7 years, the Y2K threat. You know, all the computers were going to go down. You know, the world was going to go black out. You know, now we're worrying about terrorists, dropping planes onto all the cities and stuff like that. I mean, we're in a constant state of terror, worried about, drive-by shootings, earthquakes, fires, all these things, volcanoes going off. Anything can do us in at any time. You know, the food we're eating, diseases, all that kind of stuff. Don't you think there's something there that would cause us to evolve? I mean, the pressure's on. Why aren't we changing into something else? Okay? This guy says, because it doesn't happen. I mean, everybody here kind of, I mean, you could live your life perfectly without evolution. I mean, when was the last time you absolutely depended on the theory of evolution to get you through the day? I mean, think about it. It's not observable. Success among certain biologists, philosophers, psychologists, notwithstanding, the explanatory doctrines of biological evolution do not stand up to an objective, in-depth criticism. They go away. They fade. When you start firing ammunition at these things, they can't take it. They prove to be either in conflict with reality or else incapable of solving the major problems involved. They're not science. They don't help in any way. They hinder. They take a lot of money going for projects that are dead ends. They're still looking for, some trace of evolution on Mars or the moon. Who cares? If something did evolve there, it's died out since. Why are we looking for it? And obviously what they knew couldn't help them. How's it going to help us? Okay. The universe is here. Life in our magnificent universe is here. Intelligence is here. Morality is here. What is their ultimate cause? How do you get morality in a people that evolve from things that have no sense of morals whatsoever? Since the effect is never prior or superior to the cause, it stands to reason that the cause of life must be both antecedent to it and more powerful than the universe. A living intelligence that is itself of a moral source. Just look at yourself. You, more than anything, are a proof that there's a God. Because of all that's inside of you. If nothing else, just how complicated the human body is. The old argument is if you were walking down the street and you found a stopwatch laying in the dirt, would you automatically assume that it had just evolved there? That without any help whatsoever, some molecule decided, I'm going to be a stopwatch. And evolved into it. No. Anytime you see something that's got a complicated design, you want to know who put it together, who made it, who designed it. Anything that's complicated. And you're not going to find anything more complicated than the human body. And you think it just happened? We're going to get more into that into other things, but I mean, there's a lot of things, you know, that can't evolve just because of what has to happen in order for them to evolve. They have to be designed. Or they blow up. Or they kill themselves. But more than that, we talked last week about an aesthetic quality of you appreciating sunsets. Where'd that come from? Or your ability to think. Where did that come from? Or your sense of morality or ethics? Fairness. I mean, even the worst, you know, evolutionary disciple, you know, if he works hard to get his degree and you don't give it to him, doesn't he think it's unfair? Yeah. He's got a sense of right and wrong. Where'd he get it from? Since it's all got to have a superior cause, he got it from something that has a superior intellect and sense of morality and sense of aesthetics. I mean, why else, as we read last week, you start off with Genesis, after God made everything, he looked at it and goes, hey man, this is good. He liked it. That comes from God. Certain things God likes and certain things he doesn't. Certain things God loves and certain things he hates. Okay. We need to be more in tune with our first cause, with our Creator. We need to be more dependent on Him and looking to Him for the things that we need. Because it all comes from Him. He supplies it all. We're not self-sufficient, however you want to think of yourself. Your life depends on God. And that life depends, on a godly life, depends on a good relationship with Him. How is your relationship with your Creator? It should be intact right now. It should be at optimum. If it isn't, if there's anything we can do to help, please let us know as we stand to sing.